Okay, our next case is State versus Williams. Again, State versus Williams. Good morning.
Good morning. Your Honors, my name is Kyle Flengey, and along with James Scarf, I represent Austin Williams, and may it please the court. This case comes down to three.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Can you say your name again, please?
Kyle Flengey.
And did you sign in, Mr. Flengey?
I did not, Your Honor. I would be asking for permission to argue today.
That's fine, but will you stop by the clerk's office and do that, then get signed in after you?
I can do that, yes.
That'd be great. All right, you may proceed.
We're here to argue three issues today. The first would be that there was insufficient evidence to convict my client, Austin Williams, of assault of a third-degree sex assault of a child, a 3A felony, which he was sentenced to 30 months imprisonment and 18 months post-release supervision. We're also arguing that there was a misapplication of Nebraska Revised Statute 29-2260 and that Mr. Williams was excessively sentenced in this case. As it comes to insufficient evidence, the state's brief argues that, given light to the prosecution, and giving weight to everything that the prosecution presented, Mr. Williams should be found guilty based on testimony by E.T., the minor child, as well as inappropriate text messages from between Mr. Williams and the minor child, and Mr. Williams' incriminating statements during interviews with authority. I do believe that it's important to point out that the text messages that the state is alluding to in their brief were discovered, and it is testified to by the victim's stepmother that those text messages were discovered before E.T.'s initial disclosure. I do believe that that is important. If there was something in those text messages that was overly over the top or on the basis of illegal, the stepmother or father of that child, I would hope, would have brought them forward. I don't believe that many, if any, of those text messages were presented to the jury in this case as well.
Mr. Flengey, you're talking about text messages that were the actual text messages received in evidence so the jury could consider them.
Were they?
Yes.
Yes, I believe they were, Your Honor.
Okay. They're not in our record. Did you ask for the exhibits to be included in our bill of exceptions?
I believe that we asked for everything to be included in the bill of exceptions.
They're not there. So since they're not there, what is our obligation in terms of how we consider that evidence?
I would believe that your obligation would be to consider it as it doesn't exist. That would be my
opinion. Now, why would we do that? Because do you have some case law to support that assertion?
I do not, Your Honor.
Isn't the case law actually the opposite, that we would assume that evidence that was not provided, it's your responsibility to make sure that we have all that evidence? If you don't do that, isn't our responsibility to assume that it is inculpatory?
I do not know the case law on that, Your Honor. I apologize if the technical.
Okay, so you didn't provide it and you don't know the answer.
Yes.
Okay.
Again, I do believe that it's important to, again, clarify that these text messages were.
Let's not talk about the text messages. We don't have them.
Okay. The next point that the state's argument made was statements made by Mr. Williams there, and the state provides no examples of these statements in their brief. I don't believe that there were any incriminating statements made by our client during this process. He complied with any and everything that with the authorities during their investigation.
Well, so if we agree with you on those two points, we're down to the victim's testimony, E.T.'s testimony.
That's correct.
And as I understand your argument, it really goes to her credibility because you maintain she changed her story as time went on.
That's correct. E.T.'s testimony is The credibility is definitely at issue.
And how do we on appeal evaluate that?
It's your duty to, if I'm right on the case law, to apply that in the light that's favorable to the prosecution.
Yeah, on credibility matters, don't we generally defer to the trial court?
Yeah, I've heard the witness. You would generally defer to the trier fact or the trial court itself, yes.
And I don't believe you assigned error to the admission of the testimony of the expert about the delayed reporting of child victims.
I do not believe so, no. I was not trial counsel, but so I can't answer that 100%, but I do not believe.
But at least on appeal, you have not assigned that.
Yes.
Evidence, the admission of that evidence as error.
Yes, that's correct. And as you alluded to ET's testimony, it is our argument that that is her testimony was not credible due to the fact that she did change her mind and admitted to lying on the stand multiple times. And the fact that her younger sister testified to the exact opposite of what she had testified to previously. I would next, further in the our side of the insufficient evidence argument, we lay out that the expert in this case, Barbara Sturgis, never met with the victim. She never met with the police. She never read one police report in this case. She never met with the lead investigator, and she met with the initial family advocacy network worker at the day of trials when she met with her. That another witness that the state brought was Michaela Harmon. She was the forensic interview specialist. She testified to the fact that she has no advanced degree, no degree in psychology. She has a certificate that she obtained with 40 hours of training, and then she was able to do these forensic interviews with that 40-hour certificate. And we believe that her testimony is not credible due to her lack of training.
Mr. Flinge, one of the arguments that you I believe is made in your brief has to do with the fact that your client was found not guilty of most of the charges, and so the court or the jury weighed that testimony and found him not guilty on those charges, but guilty of the final charge. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's the general basis of the argument.
Here's my question. It seems like there's an issue here that makes it difficult to analyze that issue, and that is a jury was instructed that they did not have to reach a unanimous verdict to find your client not guilty.
Mm-hmm.
Was that a correct instruction?
It was not, Your Honor.
Okay. So we really don't know how many jurors thought he was guilty and how many thought he was not guilty. Is that on those charges? But we just know that some of them, since they weren't unanimous, they were told you can find him not guilty.
That's correct.
Okay. So what does that do to your argument?
I still believe in the jury system. Even when one instruction is wrong, the jury still came back and found him guilty or not guilty of counts 1 through 4.
Well, we don't know if two people thought he was not guilty or 10 people thought he was not guilty. Is that correct?
That's correct. And obviously there's not a whole lot of case law involving this type of thing, as the jury instructions are like this are normally not made an error. I would also like to point out very quickly that I believe that our client was excessively sentenced and that the district court misapplied Nebraska Revised Statute 29-2260. 2260, in my opinion, is meant to, and it states in subsection 3 that those factors are meant to weigh in the defendant's favor if applied for purposes of not putting that person in prison or in imprisonment.
What did you mean in your second assigned error that the trial judge applied 29-2260 contrary to Article 1, Section 15 of the Nebraska Constitution? What did you mean exactly?
I believe that I just meant that he misapplied that statute on as applied. It just.
Is it really intended to be part of your excessive sentence that probation wasn't given? Is it?
Yeah.
Kind of the same.
I believe that there was a little bit of a mix up. It's more meant as a, we believe that he should have been sentenced to probation. We believe that the trial court misinterpreted 2260 subsection 3 specifically when he's going through those factors and using them as the gateway to sending our client to prison instead of using them as some sort of justification for having our client serve a term of probation. I believe that it is intertwined with the excessive sentence argument. It's all in the same. He was excessively sentenced. He had no criminal history, and the court.
You weren't attempting to challenge the constitutionality of the statute itself.
No. Okay. Not on it. We were not attempting to challenge the statute on its face. Just stating that the statute was misapplied, and it probably should have been a better fit for our excessive sentence argument itself.
Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court. My name is Austin Relf. I represent the state of Nebraska. Three issues on appeal: the sufficiency of the evidence, the constitutionality of 29-2260, and then whether the sentence imposed was excessive. We maintain, as I set forth in my brief, that the evidence was sufficient to support the conviction, that the constitutionality of 29-2260 is not properly before this court.
And he just kind of indicated he wasn't really challenging the constitutionality of the statute.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess he can say that after the fact, but how I read the brief, I mean, the assigned error is the court's application of 29-2260 was contrary to Article 1, Section 15 of the Constitution of the State of Nebraska. I guess I just took the assigned error for what it said. To the extent it's not, then, we can push it to the excessive sentence argument, but the excessive sentence argument, he never talked about 29-2260. Mm-hmm. He talked only about the incarceration of the defendant. And in our view, looking at the record, the district court clearly did not abuse its discretion, did not discuss any appropriate factors, did not impose an excessively arduous sentence of 30 months imprisonment on a class 3A felony. It's not even the max. Mm-hmm. And it was a very serious offense based on the evidence produced at trial. So, in our view, it's pretty apparent that it is not an excessively lenient sentence, it's not an excessive sentence, and so should be affirmed by this court. As far as the sufficiency, maintain, as I did in my brief, that the victim's testimony plus the incriminating statements, which the detective testified at trial, if my recollection serves, to numerous statements that we think were inculpatory or incriminating. For example, he testified that he couldn't remember exactly what happened on the March 17th incident, but if there was something, some assault that occurred, it was possible that it occurred then. Not probable, but possible. He also said, I'm not calling E.T. a liar, I just don't remember what happened. Those types of inculpatory statements that are, I guess, conceding the possibility of an assault are incriminating him for view. Additionally, the testimony of E.T., I think, by itself is sufficient. That's by statute. I forget the exact number right now, but the statute in 29-2028, the testimony of a person who is a victim of sexual assault as defined in sections 28-319-320.01 shall not require corroboration. So the victim's testimony on its own, as Judge Moore, I think, hinted at, would be sufficient to support the conviction here.
How do we deal with the lack of the exhibits? How do we treat that?
Well, you can do it, I guess, a number of ways. The first would be that it's the appellant's burden to produce a record to support his assigned error versus his failure to do so. I think the law would say, the cases say, that you could affirm on that basis alone. My review of the exhibits, the index to the exhibits, I should say, is that they weren't necessarily just based on the bill of exceptions and the testimony weren't necessarily all that important. And I think the sufficiency can be made out based, like I said, on the testimony alone in the bill of exceptions. So the lack of the exhibits, I don't think necessarily prevents this court from addressing the sufficiency on the merits. But to the extent it does, it would be.
Because that would be a problem, wouldn't it? Well, if appellants sure. could just choose to not put exhibits into the record.
And sure. You know, but what we have here, I think, is sufficient to say, yeah, there was sufficient evidence to support the conviction. And in the event that it wasn't, well, it's your burden to produce a bill of exceptions and you failed to do that. So we should affirm on that ground. I think that covers all of the assigned errors. Unless this court had further questions, submit on the brief. The rest of it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rao. And I don't think there's any rebuttal time. Okay. Thank you very much, counsel. The matter is submitted.
Thank you.
Thank you. And please don't forget to sign in, Mr. Flinging.